up, everybody? Dr. Joe Camerata here. Now, before we get into the podcast, I had a simple request, and that is if you like our podcast, go ahead and give us a rating of 5 stars. It will only take you 1 second and will really help to spread the strong word that we are talking about here every week on the Cross Continuum podcast. I know you'll enjoy the podcast, so let's get into it, and thank you very much. What is up, everybody? This is Dr. Joe Camerata with the Across the Continuum podcast. I'm here with Dr. Sophia Varis, and we're going to talk about women's health today and lifting. And I'm super pumped. I don't know anybody who is both as strong as Sophia and can speak as well about women's health when it comes to being in the gym. And so I'm going to kick it to you, Sophia. Will you please just like run us through your mile long CV so that we can start talking about lifting in the female sphere?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I'm excited to deep dive into all topics of women's health and lifting. A little bit about how I kind of got into this. So I went to physical therapy school at Northeastern, where I ended up on the Northeastern powerlifting team, and I'm still powerlifting to this day. It's kind of how I ended up into this specialty of women and lifting in the physical therapy route. And I teach people how to do the same. So how to bridge this gap. Instructor for barbell rehab, where I actually have my own course on maneuvering through this gap specifically for women's health topics. And this is something I'm really passionate about. So I'm excited to answer all of the questions that you have and any of your viewers may have too.
I wanted to linger on the barbell rehab stuff, because you're knee deep in barbell rehab. You know, you're on the seminar staff. I mean, you're in Texas right now, I assume, putting on some sort of barbell rehab-ness, right?
Yes, I'm excited. This is actually probably one of my biggest seminars to date. I'm going to be lecturing at Texas Strength Systems. And this is like the mecca of at least my world of strength and conditioning. So I'm very excited to be lecturing there. But yeah, so I do teach the barbell rehab certification course, which is what I'm doing this weekend. But then I also have my own online course that dives into the topics that aren't talked about enough in the strength and conditioning world.
Sure. And I, you know, personally, I have considered going through the unique considerations for the female lifter. I haven't done it yet, but I'm hoping that, you know, maybe this will enlighten me to the point where I could just, you know, totally avoid having to pay Mike anything more in my life.
Love it. No, I definitely think, especially if you work with a lot of female athletes and you just manage to be coming across these issues, particularly as we talk about things like urinary incontinence and heavy lifting, as well as how to train through pregnancy, the postpartum, and then how to adjust training in maybe the outskirts of life where we don't have as many of the hormonal adaptations playing a role, like with the prepubescent female or the postmenopausal female, and just kind of how to maneuver that through strength training.
And the last thing I wanted to linger on was the lifting heavy things. Can you just run us through your like trophy case here?
Yes. So some of my biggest accomplishments, while I was at Northeastern, I did get the chance to go to Worlds and won collegiate Worlds, not just by myself, but with my team. So we all won together and we got a perfect score. So each of us came in first place. And as a team, we came in first place. So that was really special. Since then, I've placed at Nationals multiple times. I've won the Arnold and continue to compete and perform at a high level.
Amazing. I mean, I have recently shifted away from powerlifting because I suck at it. And so it's like, how does it feel to just crush it?
I would say it takes the long term. So I've been doing this 10 years now, and I've only gotten better by the years, where I feel like I finally come into my own as a competitor on the stage. And I know how to control my emotions on meet day, my energy, how to step it up when it's time to step it up, but how to calm down just as quickly. So it's nice to just be finding that stride for yourself. And I feel like we've only scraped the surface, and I'm excited to see what's to come.
Heck yeah. All right, well, let's get into it. So, I mean, I feel like the first softball question, which, you know, when it comes to lifting in the States, at least, and honestly, in on the globe, the question of like, why aren't enough people lifting is something that consistently makes us scratch our heads. I mean, we know that it's a good idea, but specifically in the female space, why do you feel like women aren't lifting enough?
This problem is complex and multifactorial, but I'll dive into a few of the bigger kind of moving pieces here. I think for way too long, women were encouraged to be small and tiny and petite, and anything that may change that was frowned upon. So even myself, I remember in my younger ages, seeing these women on the magazines, they were all small and tiny, and even the actresses, you know, I love Jennifer Aniston, but again, smaller and petite. And these were the women that we looked up to and wanted to be like. So, you know, and then there was this myth, of course, that women were going to become monsters if we started strength training. So I think we've since debusted that myth, but it does still persist, particularly amongst older women. I think they still hold on to these mentalities where they're supposed to be smaller and they're afraid to, God forbid, put on 5 pounds of muscle. And you may actually look smaller with 5 pounds of muscle, but people don't fully know that until they go through the journey themselves. So I do think that's still a persistent theme that I see with women not wanting to get into it. And this theme is heavier in different cultures. Right. So I know, for example, Asian American women, very frowned down upon to become bigger and muscular. And then, you know, you have the maybe parents and grandparents that are discouraging the younger ones from doing this. And then particularly in other cultures, you know, I know Islamic women, they still have a lot that they're fighting through to just get that same equal representation on the platform. There are policies that help them, which is awesome. Like they can wear different outfits and such on the platform. But again, culturally still maybe frowned upon by the older women of this culture. And then with that, I think another big one, just cultural roles and expectations of women where we tend to be caretakers, we're moms, we put everybody else first and then put ourselves on the back burner. So I know sometimes, you know, you see the mom drop their kids off at 5 different practices, but they're struggling to scrap together their own workouts in the background. So I do think that's another big one here, but I would say those are the big themes that I've seen emerge as to why aren't more women strength training.
It does seem like a generational thing, like really a lot. I mean, if you, I don't know if your grandma's still around or if, like if she comments on your lifting, but my grandmother is horrified by the things that I do in the gym, and I don't lift weights nearly as heavy as you do. You know what I mean? Like it's if you kind of look back at like fitness, it has developed rapidly and wildly since that generation has been around. I mean, I don't even think that there were gyms like there are today or even close. Like, I don't even know if there are public gyms. And so I definitely feel like it's a generational thing because currently it seems like, and it might be my own algorithm or my own bubble, but it seems like the thickness is upon us when it comes to females, at least, or at least the ones that are, you know, rising to the top on social media. It seems like they're going in that general direction.
Definitely. It's interesting because I will say that the younger females are getting ahead of this. You know, I wish that I had had as much confidence and that someone introduced this to me younger. So they're definitely getting that benefit of seeing all these strong role models in front of them. I'm lucky to have had one strong role model where my mom has always been physically active. I'll tell you, actually, the first experience with me lifting weights was a Barbie Workout World fitness tape where I had my 1 pound pink dumbbells at like 3 years old and at least had a mom encouraging me to do this. But I will say my mom has fallen victim to the societal expectations of trying to be smaller. We're Latina and we just naturally have bigger thighs and things like that. And the shape that my mom fought against so hard, and she still worked with classes and more of the cardio based stuff. I have tried to get her to do more strength work and she will do it, but she's definitely one of those people that needs a personal trainer. Like if you put that weight on the barbell for her, she'll lift it, but she won't go to the gym by herself, set up the barbell, put the weights on and get after it. So I do think there is maybe some hand holding that they would benefit from in these situations.
It's so funny that even you, like this amazing powerlifter that has had so much success, would have so much trouble getting like probably your biggest fan to do those similar things. And the thing that I think about for you in particular is like, what sort of genetic secrets are lying within your mother's lifting ability? You know what I mean? Like, is she going to come crush the master's class if she were to get on the platform, you know? So maybe a question that will float around the universe forever. And we may never know.
Oh, I would love to sign up for a competition. I think just in general, though, she is more of those, maybe a group fitness type, and not like, let's compete and try to max out and see what happens. Although I do think she gave me a lot of these genetics that have made me a good athlete. So it'd be cool to see what she could do with them too.
And so what are women missing out on with not lifting?
Oof, so much. I mean, really has a lot of positive effects from, helping with body mass index. I think the irony is that women are afraid to get big from lifting weights, but you'll get bigger in the best of ways where you're going to put on more muscle mass and things like that, but you're not necessarily going to gain a ton of weight. It'll actually help you stay at a healthier weight, because more muscle mass means you're going to have a better metabolism. You're going to be able to eat more to support this and have the body you want. So I do think body positivity and empowerment is a big one for this. With that, one of the big ones too, bone density, stress is introduced to it, and we adapt to that stress. Something like heavy weights, and women in particular are at a higher risk of things like osteoporosis, osteopenia, that we want later in the future, or break a hip or anything like that. So those are big ones. I think another big one is the hormonal adaptations that we see from strength and conditioning, where this can really help rein in on some hormonal problems that women struggle with. Funny enough, women will avoid things like strength and conditioning when they're trying to conceive because they think it impacts fertility, but it actually positively benefits fertility. So just plug for women there. It's not necessarily going to impact your abilities, although you want to be mindful of maybe structuring your programming appropriately then. But I would say those are the big benefits that we see from strength and conditioning, particularly for women.
Yeah. And without putting on like our endocrinology hat, the hormonal thing, like the whole monthly cyclical cycle, seems like, I don't even know where personally, because I haven't read nearly as much as there is to read out there, but it seems like an odd place to land. Like, I've heard folks advocating for like changing your programming or changing your athlete's programming around whatever phase of the cycle that they're in. And I've, heard other folks say that it's more beneficial to just like subjectively adjust things as you kind of go through that. Is there somewhere that you kind of like plant your flag?
Definitely. I'm more of one to just adapt to the individual in front of you. Like with anything someone may be dealing with, naturally people are going to be very sensitive to their cycle, and others may not. Some may be on birth control, others may not, right? There's a lot of factors that go into this situation. The only time, well, besides someone who's maybe very sensitive to it, may be individuals that I adapt their training with. But again, it's just listening to the RPE and being smarter about it. But the bigger one would be in that pregnancy situation, only because if we're talking about energy demands for a second, your body wants to use energy to conceive. And if you're depleting all of that energy with a heavy strength workout around ovulation, that may not be just the best situation there. So those are the only individuals I would maybe just wean down the intensity of their training around ovulation. And then the rest is really just seeing how the person responds.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that before. I liken it to somebody who has, shin splints, or who has some sort of like burn where there's just more metabolic activity that's going on that requires more energy going in. So it's a good way to, yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. I think the thing that I want to talk about the most, which again, feels like whenever I step into like the pelvic floor, not literally, that would be nuts. Whenever I step into that, like into that category, I feel like a lot of what I know gets thrown out the window as far as like where the biopsychosocial model plays, where the biomedical model plays. Cause I feel like it's one of those categories where it's almost historically I've had to maybe like step back into a more structural way of thinking about things, just because, there's internal exams and there's folks that are having issues with hip internal rotators, and there's like, it's too tight or it's not tight enough, or it's, what have you. And so it gets confusing, because as a non-subject matter expert, but as somebody who wants to ask these questions, that I know, I almost feel like the pelvic floor space isn't super special when it comes to pain perception. But then again, I'm just not sure. And so the pelvic floor is confusing, is what I guess what I'm trying to say.
No, that's a great way to put it. I think what we're finding now, and just correlated with maybe some world you do know better, like musculoskeletal, we can appreciate that there's a pretty big gap between traditional rehab and like high level return to sport, right? And that gap has gotten smaller throughout the years, particularly with progressive physical therapists like ourselves. But I'll say in the pelvic health world, that gap is huge. And I think there's actually a large disconnect between the pelvic floor rehab that happens in a clinic and then translating that to high level performance. And that's actually my specialty interest area, is because I noticed how big that gap was. And unfortunately, maybe some of the things being practiced are not the most evidence-based, but we do know how much evidence there is to support exercise. And now you have to think with that biomechanical hat still, but like apply these exercises at a higher level. We'll break down just how the pelvic floor works for a second, where how it kind of just contracts and relaxes throughout the day. It works like a pump with the rest of your body, and it's mitigated by intra-abdominal pressure and your diaphragm. So your diaphragm rests generally up and around your rib cage in a 360-degree fashion. When you breathe in, your diaphragm descends down. And then here we have all our abdominal organs that are in the way. So they have to go somewhere and they also go down. So the diaphragm's going down, your abdominal organs are going down. The pelvic floor then has to kind of eccentrically lengthen or go down with it to absorb that kind of pressure management. And then as you naturally exhale and the diaphragm recoils up, the pelvic floor goes up with it. So it works all day long as a postural control muscle, things like that, just to help us stand up. So your pelvic floor is always working to some degree. And so then kind of two ways to go about working with it. So now you can start contracting it and things like that in terms of strength training it, but it does actually come back to this fundamental breathing. So breathing is a big component of pelvic floor rehab and learning how to own your breath and work your pelvic floor with a controlled breath, and then also learning how to work it with something like your Valsalva maneuver, which I know is a question of yours too.
Yeah, I was going to say, what a great segue. What a great, you know, podcast guest you are, to just segue into my next question. Yeah, I made a post, was last week, where I basically was like making an umbrella claim, which is never a good idea, that there's no good reason to not Valsalva while lifting weights. And I think I had like three of my pelvic health friends be like, actually, that's not good. And I have no foot to stand on when it comes to being like, I don't know, like I truly don't. And so that, I think that was one of the main final tipping points of like, all right, I need to outsource my questioning.
Yes. No, this is great. And this is one of those, I would describe it, if we were to think about how far we've come thinking about low back rounding with the deadlift, same kind of concept with the pelvic floor and the Valsalva. So I just mentioned to you guys kind of how it works with your breath. So as the diaphragm goes down, pelvic floor goes down, diaphragm rises up, the pelvic floor goes back up. So you can use this as a controlled maneuver with lifting, where, for example, if we were to do a squat with a controlled breath, it would be inhaling as we go down into the hole, eccentrically absorbing through our pelvic floor, and then concentrically pulling up and in with the pelvic floor on the way up. So that would be how to do a squat with a controlled breath. And this would be how to overload the pelvic floor. This would be like a high level exercise for pelvic floor management. You can control this breath all you want, but at about 80% of your one rep max, your body's gonna default to a Valsalva maneuver, or more of this breath hold where we now have a closure at the glottis, and that kind of compacts all of our air inside. And what we've actually found is that the pelvic floor will reflectively contract up and in with a Valsalva maneuver. So the Valsalva is not inherently dangerous for the pelvic floor. We're finding that the pelvic floor activates in response to this Valsalva maneuver. the issue that we run into is when people maybe don't have the most efficient bracing technique, and instead of contracting their pelvic floor up and in, they're pushing down on a relaxed pelvic floor. And this would be essentially what happens with bowel movements when you go into the bathroom and you're pushing down, or during labor when women are pushing down on a relaxed pelvic floor. And that can be one of the things that may be contributing to urinary incontinence, whether it's with managing intra-abdominal pressure with something like a sneeze or a cough, or with something like a squat or a deadlift.
I'm over here. I mean, you can't tell, but I'm doing a little dance over here, trying to do all these things that I assume is, you know, an eccentric concentric contraction, or, you know, as if I were in labor, trying to feel what it is that you're talking about over here. I mean, when you said the under 80%, it makes me think of almost like a drawing in maneuver that we learned in physical therapy school, where there's this kind of preparatory activity that happens, but once you get to the actual like thing, the show, so to speak, or that over 80% of a lift, it kind of just goes out the window. Not that it goes totally out the window, but I didn't know that there was a kind of like an upward contraction when the Valsalva did happen. It almost sounds like, not to point the finger back at the person having the urinary incontinence, but they don't know how to Valsalva maybe. Like, would that be an adequate way to think about it? Or is it just, well, I don't know.
There's a lot that can go into this equation. So the breath and the brace is one part of it, but the best brace in the world doesn't matter if you drank a gallon of water before training, right? So bladder habits can play into this. When and what people are consuming, if we're thinking about not just water itself, but bladder irritants like caffeine, if people take their pre-workouts or creatine, those kind of things can play into it. When are they taking it in relation to their training? But yes, it's multifactorial in that sense that there's a lot going on in the equation besides just the Valsalva, the breathing, the bracing. And then I think sometimes people get too biomedical and like forget that there's the other components. There's that psychosocial fear too, where you're like, am I going to pee this time? Should I go to the bathroom real quick? You know, you're almost like a nervous pee habit if you've ever experienced that with sports. So even that can play into it as well. But learning how to work with all of these things is ultimately how you get the real solution for pelvic floor problems here.
You can imagine my surprise when I learned that you could just not drink and help with urinary incontinence, you know, and for those folks that aren't super familiar with urinary incontinence, there's a bunch of different types, right? I mean, the two that come to my head are stress and urgency, or they might be the same thing, but I can't remember. But again, you can imagine my surprise when I was like, oh, you can just drink less water. But that's still, I mean, it's still like the way that I've kind of defaulted to coaching my female athletes who may or may not have this is almost as a graded exposure type fashion when it comes to getting to those intensities or loads that create this urinary incontinence. And it's like, well, let's just go a little bit underneath that. And again, I'm here to say, I'm not quite sure if that is the right way to do it either, but to, you know, in my brain, it rattles around that would help with training whatever mechanism needs to be trained to help with more tolerance. Is that a good way to think about it?
100%. So in addition to addressing things like the breathing, the bracing, the urinary habits, the bladder habits, you got to address you'll find kind of two big struggles. Some people may struggle with load. Some struggle more with reps. Some it's a combination of both of them. And then there's also different muscle types of the pelvic floor too, in terms of our fast twitch and our slow twitch muscles and being able to control these. So heavy lifting is one of the big provocative things for things like stress urinary incontinence. But if you work with CrossFitters at all, jumping rope, the double unders, that's more of that rep endurance work. And so you need to learn how to train the pelvic floor in both fashions because it has to work in both fashions. So some people, right, are better at big, strong contractions with their muscles. Others are better at reps, and you have to train up the system that maybe that individual is not as proficient in. And it's like you said, you find that threshold and then you work slightly underneath it and build tolerance and capacity as well as the technique there too.
Now, is the path forward to try and make things as specific as possible to the context that you're having difficulty with? And if so, how do you recommend females who are having this issue go about training this in maybe like a public setting?
Yes, this is a great question. So honestly, this is why there's a big disconnect between pelvic floor rehab and then return to performance, because it is specific. You have to get these women doing the activity that bothers them, like squatting, deadlifting, jumping rope. And that doesn't tend to happen as much in the pelvic rehab world. So they do need to train up these movement patterns and work in that fashion. And then as far as bridging the gap, so step one is just getting familiar with this area. Fun fact, you have a pelvic floor too, and you can learn how to control it. So actually the first step is getting to know this area. Literally go in front of a mirror, legs open, see if you can control your breathing, see if you can get a contraction. And even thinking about this, we've forever been discouraged about talking about our pelvic floors. Like this is, maybe in the past 5 years, the conversation has changed. But even then, we've always called these private parts, right? We were taught to cover them and we can't talk about them. And it's inappropriate, right, to bring up these things. So for a long time, we haven't even really broached this area, right? We're like, oh, okay, I guess we know how to work it or not. So step one is getting familiar with it and just seeing if you can notice these things in a mirror. So again, you just sit in front of it. You see if you can get that kind of downward eccentric relaxation and then that pull up and in with a coordinated breath. As you start, you get better at training this. So now that you get what does a rep look like and feel like, you can start adding in two kind of different concepts. So one of it is longer time or longer duration holds. Think like building this up. You may get a flutter initially, right? Because it's hard to kind of hold and contract. And then building it up 3 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds. Keeping in mind how long a squat may take, right? Something like that. Learning how to be able to hold it for longer periods of time. And then the other capacity is just building up reps, right? Step one is to just figure out what one rep is like. And then, hey, can you string a few together? But still making sure it's not partial reps. If you were to think about the pelvic floor, like the biceps, you don't want to just stay in like the very small middle range. You want to make sure even with your rep work, you're still getting the full up and down. So step one is just getting that part. Then you have to figure out how to translate it from sitting in front of the mirror to how am I going to get it to like a 200 to 300 pound squat. So from there, I like to work to help bridge that gap. One of my favorites is the leg press, especially if you were sitting in front of the mirror in that position, very similar to the leg press. And the leg press makes it so you're not standing. So you can just focus on the breath, figuring out how to coordinating it on the inhale, exhale through the movement. Once you get better at that, or not necessarily once you get better with that, but another one that I really love here is the TRX squat. Again, you're just eliminating some of the other factors from the equation, like balance, and you can just focus on this breathing and bracing. And then eventually you translate this over, just like you would, let's say someone with low back pain, right? You do a partial rep and then you move forward. Same exact thing here. And then you gradually start loading it. And then there are a few maybe specific variations I love to specifically work on this on a high level return to sport phase as well.
Man, I got to think that the provider patient relationship in this scenario has got to be great for this sort of, I mean, for this sort of subjective reporting to be helpful, right? I'd probably just be like, I'm good. I feel great.
You definitely have to learn how to be like a cool physical therapist, right? You have to take topics that people do not want to talk about at all. And you're like, nope, we're talking about sex. We're talking about your pee habits. We're talking about your pooping habits. I want to know all the dirt. And like, I'm not judging any of this. I'm here to help you with it. And I think just getting someone to feel comfortable with you is huge. And then I will say that this area may be one that people have dealt with different styles of trauma with. Right. We think about this biopsychosocial model with pain and let's say low back pain, for example, and fear avoidance, and you don't want to move or use this area. Or That can happen actually a lot in the pelvic health world. Sexual trauma is unfortunately a lot more prevalent than I would like it to be. And that is one of those things that people may not even feel comfortable like talking about. But again, I need to know everything that may be influencing your connection to this area. So those are the topics that are maybe the hardest to broach, but also the most important to talk about as well. And again, as a physical therapist, you just have to be really open and show them that you're here to care and not judge and listen and help them through it.
For sure. I mean, you hate to get that person who's at that point where they're like, I can't hold back anymore, right? I can't save face anymore because, you know, something's fallen out of me that needs to be stuffed back. You know, like it just, because folks do get to a point where you're like, man, I wish you had told me a year ago that something like this was happening. But you definitely don't want to get somebody where they're at a point where like, I can't not say anything anymore. As far as like home stuff, because in the, at least the orthopedic musculoskeletal world, there's a lot of things that folks can buy at home, maybe, you know, cups or K-tape or dry needles or what have you. I've talked to a few friends who are in the public health space that said that there's a lot of biofeedback stuff that is on the market now. Is that something that folks can use at home? Because I have here written on my desk, like, are Kegels dead? And my assumption is, yeah, maybe. But it seems like if I ever talk to anybody about pelvic floor stuff, they're like, I've been doing my Kegels, I'm good, right? Is biofeedback maybe a better way to go about pelvic floor training at home? And is that an accessible thing for people to use?
It can definitely be really helpful, especially if people are maybe just not even performing the contraction right, right? They're just sitting in front of the mirror and they're like, I have no idea what's even happening. So it's a nice way to get that visual feedback, or, you know, at least the monitor allows you to see, hey, am I actually contracting this? Or maybe other things contracting instead? So there are a lot of other muscles that can take over. Like sometimes people think they're squeezing, but they're really just clenching their butt or their adductors instead. So that can be a helpful learning tool, something that they can do on their own. There's still a time and a place for Kegels. I think the bigger thing is learning how to translate that Kegel later, right? Once you get it, don't just stop at that. Figure out how to load it, right? Because it's like doing, let's say, transverse abdominis. There's a time and place for these things too, but just flexing your abs on its own is not going to help you for a 300-pound squat. You have to eventually load these smaller muscle groups and teach them how to connect with the whole as well. So there's a time and a place for both the isolated pelvic floor work, and then eventually you have to translate this over into whatever specific activity they're trying to do.
Sure. So if somebody's listening who has some sort of incontinence or something while they're lifting, and they've gotten in front of the mirror and they're like, all right, I don't know what the hell is going on. Is there something specific? And I know that you can't really give a specific recommendation for this, you know, kind of widespread issue. Is there something, like, if somebody were like, I don't know how to lift, I'd be like, just do some squats, right? Is there a recommendation you can give that can help folks who may be having this problem without having them go in to see somebody for pelvic health stuff, or no?
Well, I would say the getting to know your pelvic floor in the mirror is definitely step one. It's just figuring out, can I even connect my brain with this body area? And then, like, let's go into something that you do know how to teach. Think about every time you ever taught someone a row, right? Some people are going to get it pretty quickly. You don't even have to like, and then others are going to look like they've got chicken wings and they're shrugging and they're not really rowing, right? And so those are the people that may benefit from some coaching, right? There's a reason we're coaches, because people need to, but not everybody, right? So I would say try it on your own, see what it feels like, see what it looks like. And then if you're like, you know what, I actually kind of need someone to coach me through this, that would be the time to then maybe follow up with a pelvic floor specialist. Another example would be like hip hinging, right? Yes, some people get it down, they figure it out, no problem. Other people, you're working on it on a month and you're just like, all right, we're just going to start pulling round back deadlifts, because this may or may not come soon, but you can keep working on those things while we start loading you up here too.
And as a remote coach, do you get a lot of folks who need this sort of specific help? Because I know that you're do a lot of powerlifting coaching. Is there a space in collaborative strength that is like just for incontinence for males or females?
Definitely. I usually focus on more of that later phase. So most people have maybe tried the pelvic floor route and they're like, I did the pelvic floor PT, but it didn't help me. Those are the people I really help take it to that next level. But I do work with pregnancy and the postpartum, and I build this into their programming. So ideally, if you can do pelvic floor strength training before you even get pregnant, ideally, or during pregnancy, it can mitigate your risk of dealing with these issues in the postpartum. Because now, imagine this for a second. Let's say you were never even connected to this region in the first place, and then your body goes through a tremendous amount of changes over 9 months, and then again, even more changes, you're going to be totally disconnected from this area. You're like, I don't even know how to flex my abs, let alone my pelvic floor. But if you can get ahead of it, it's almost like prehab for ACL. It's like, do as much as you can ahead of time, and it's just going to set you up for a better postpartum. So this is something I already weave in and integrate, particularly into pregnancy. And I've seen better outcomes in the postpartum, but I've also seen a better chance of delivering via vaginal delivery versus C-section, because now you're stronger for it. So lots of benefits to strength training during pregnancy. There's still a lot of things to be mindful of there. And that's something to maybe work with a coach on, so that, and your doctors as well. But I've seen tremendous results where if you can get ahead of these things, then any later phases are just that much easier to redevelop these skills.
If you ever needed a excuse for your wife to get her into lifting while pregnant, or whomever, you know, again, a whole other podcast about lifting while pregnancy. And I feel like a whole other rock that hasn't been overturned, but not getting cut open to get a baby out of you seems like a good motivation to do some sort of strength training while pregnant. Cool. Well, I think that's all I have. Honestly, you answered all my questions swimmingly. Where can folks find more from you?
Definitely. You can find me on Instagram at sof.squats, or you can also reach out to us at Collaborative Strength. That's where I do primarily powerlifting coaching, as well as bridging the gap from rehab to return to performance. But I also do remote consults. So if you just want to chat, pick my brain, come up with some strategies for how to work through pelvic floor issues, you can reach out to me there.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.